diversions when necessary. Someone with power. Someone with nowhere else to turn. Someone with absolutely no moral qualms, who would happily follow orders to maim, torture, or kill as Peaks required. And thus, he had come here, to this particular stretch of desert. Peaks returned to his parked rented car, now broiling hot under the desert sun. He pulled clothing from his bag and dressed quickly. He turned on the engine and the air conditioning and opened his laptop. He stuck the stolen hard drive into the USB slot and opened a file he'd read many times before. Then he opened the detailed analysis derived from news reports, police reports of strange deaths, and the reports of sadistic rapes. The clever geeks at the ranch had cross-tabbed all the data they had, analyzed possible hiding places, and reached a tentative conclusion. Quail Mountain. Peaks drove the few miles to Juniper Flats, nothing but a flat space between mountains, but an easy place to take the trail that led across a mile and a half of sun-blasted desert to Quail Mountain. He had a large bottle of Fiji water weighing down one side of his light jacket and granola bars stuffed into the other pocket. He carried a burner phone with a spare battery pack, not that there was any coverage out in the middle of nowhere, and because he was still far from sure of how exactly to use the monster that now lived within him, he carried a Colt 45 automatic pistol and a spare clip. It was not so easy to search the mountain. Quail Mountain was almost 6,000 feet high and cut with multitudes of gullies, eroded by the infrequent rain and more frequent wind, each of which was an obstacle to movement. Other obstacles were prickly bushes and cacti, the blinding sun, the burning heat, and the ever-present possibility of poisonous reptiles. He soon wished he had more water and better boots. Hours of climbing yielded no clues, and by the time the sun touched the distant western horizon, he was feeling defeated. He was torn between continuing his search and racing back to the car, now something like 3 miles away, and continuing the search the next day, or sticking it out, possibly through the night. In the end, he could not bear the thought of slogging all the way back to his car and spending the night in a motel. So he gathered bits of brush and knocked the limbs off a dead Joshua tree and made a fire. He made the fire the old-fashioned way, with a lighter. That fact made him grin. Night came with a suddenness familiar to those who've stayed too long in the desert. The fire soon consumed the dry-as-dust kindling, and he had little of anything larger to burn. So he sat hunched over in front of the dying embers as the sky above blazed with stars and planets. He listened to the two near yips of coyotes. He had no warning. Half asleep, he heard a sound like a bat flitting through the air, and then something was around his chest, and he was yanked away from the fire and onto his back. He yelled an inarticulate, "Hey!" And the thing that had grabbed him now pulled away, only to come slicing forward to land on him with such force that it tore his jacket open at the shoulder, ripped through the shirt beneath, and bit into his flesh. Ha! The pain was shocking, and Peaks was mortally certain that he would be dead in a matter of minutes, if not seconds, but in his pain and panic, he still cried out just the right word. Drake! No second blow fell. The pain was what branded cattle must feel. But he rose shakily to his feet, trying to peer into the darkness. "You know me?" The voice was oily smooth, utterly confident, unafraid, but curious. "Yes, I know who you are. You're Drake Merwin. I've been looking for you." Peaks heard someone move closer, but stood his ground. And slowly, Drake emerged from the pitch black into the weak orange light and sinister shadows cast by the embers of the fire. Drake stood tall, relaxed, his 10-foot-long tentacle arm wrapped casually around his waist, the tip twitching eagerly. He was, Peaks thought, exactly as he'd pictured him, handsome but cruel, with a predatory animal quality to his gaze. The nightmare of the PBA. The killer, the rapist, the torturer, the brutal psychopathic monster, Drake Merwin.
Well, you found me, Drake said laconically.
I have a proposition for you, Peek said, tenderly touching the agonizing slash on his chest.
You are not the first to claim he had some good reason why I shouldn't whip him to death. And the women, oh, they always have some sob story to tell.
Drake laughed. Peek swallowed his revulsion at this, at the vicious scenes his imagination supplied. Tell you what, Drake, I'll say what I have to say, and then you decide what to do with me.
I decide regardless, Drake said with a sneer. But tell me your story.
Okay, Peek said, shaking with fear, fighting the urgent pain. But Peek's was not overly worried. Drake could not defeat him, not if he morphed. That said, he knew he could not morph into the monster if Drake struck too quickly. First, do you recall a certain Deca Talent?
Drake's hiss sounded like a rattlesnake's.
One of the things I'd like you to do, Drake, is kill Deca Talent. There was a long silence, and then Drake unlimbered his whip arm and casually uprooted a bush, which he tossed onto the fire, causing it to flare brightly. Drake sat down, cross-legged, his whip arm now draped over his shoulders, a slow, writhing python.
I'm listening, Drake said.
The world is changing. Changing in ways none of us can really imagine. ASO, the rock. The one that became the Gaiaphage. That same rock. More of it is landing. It was my job to stop it getting out into the hands of, you know, civilians, regular people.
Drake's eyes narrowed. But that effort has failed.
The rock is out in the world, already in too many hands, and with it comes incredible unpredictable powers.
Just like the good old days, Drake said.
Actually much worse. You see, the rock is like an opportunistic virus. It affects, it interacts with its entire environment, using whatever it finds at hand to shape the change.
The change?
The only two people to escape the PBA with powers intact were the two people who were physically changed, morphed. Taylor and you, Drake.
Drake was perfectly still, listening, waiting, like a cobra watching a mouse. The end of his whip twitched.
The rock, very much like a clever virus, has found a way to survive without the dome. It altered the physiognomy, sorry, the body, creating a sort of hybrid creature made out of the person's DNA, any other DNA that happened to be nearby, and in some cases seemed affected by need, by desire. As if it was reading synapses inside the brain, feeding on memory, on passion.
Peeks shook his head ruefully, admiringly. Oh, it is a very, very clever piece of work, this rock. Millennia ahead of human science.
He snapped out of a reverie and looked into Drake's soulless eyes. They will win. The rock will have its way, you see. That's clear to me now. I don't know why. I don't know what it plans, but it is not a mere virus. No, it is being watched. Perhaps it is a sort of lens that allows connections through a bent and folded space-time, I don't know. But I know that some consciousness is watching.
Drake nodded. I know it. It never left me.
This got Peek's attention. Are you telling me it's in your head ever since before and after? Drake said in a dreamy tone.
It never leaves me. Just like she never leaves me.
She. Drake grinned. He tugged at the neckline of his filthy t-shirt and pulled it down to reveal the pale flesh beneath. And there, like some mad 3D tattoo, was a face,
the face of a girl with twisted braces wires sticking out from between cracked lips. The Brittany pig, Drake said, enjoying the look of horror on Peeks's face. We were melded long ago, me and Brittany pig. But our relationship has changed, you know? We used to be two separate people, one replacing the other at times. But eventually, she grew on me. Get it? His laugh was a form of assault, a brutal challenge. She grew on me? Peeks managed to nod, but did not trust his voice. The face on Drake's chest was not an illusion, not a tattoo. It was a living face, mouthing silently, staring at him with eyes that were windows into madness. Sometimes she says their words, Drake said. Sometimes the banshees wail, and it comes out here. He tapped the face, and the braces-filled mouth snapped at his finger. The banshees, Peeks whispered. Them, the dark ones, the demons, the dark watchers. What do they say? Peeks asked. Drake made a mirthless chuckle. Mostly it's kill. Yes, they like that. Killing, pain, terror. It entertains them. They like to be entertained. Peeks had seen freaks. He had created freaks. Nightmarish creatures, like Carl. He had a very high threshold when it came to fear. But the thin, handsome, vicious boy, with the living face on his chest, and the lightning-quick whip hand, well, this was a new level of malice. This was a creature in long-term, close contact with the Dark Watchers that Peeks had only glimpsed or read about in the statements of experimental subjects. There was a force about Drake, a sort of invisible but unmistakable aura of malignancy. I tried to recruit the stable one, Peeks reminded himself. I tried to do the right thing. Time to try the wrong thing, Peeks muttered under his breath. Here's the thing, Drake. I just underwent my own change. I became, well, very powerful. Very powerful. I know half your mind is thinking of killing me, but you would not succeed. Not with just your whip hand. There was a tantalizing suggestion buried in there somewhere, and Drake sensed it. What do you want? Drake asked. Same question Dekka asked more than once. Well, it's a fair question, Peeks thought. What do I want? I wanted once to save the world. That realization was bitter now. Save the world? Save the world from superpowered freaks like, well, like Peeks had now become, like this sick piece of once-human garbage with the whip. And now, what did Peeks want now? To survive in the world that was coming, to be the greatest of the powers, to dominate, to control, to prove himself and avenge his humiliation. Yes, he still wanted to save the world, but the world he saved would be his world, a world where he received the recognition he deserved. But first and foremost, he had to acquire as much of the precious rock as he could, keep it safe and under his control. With the Mother Rock, Peeks could stop the government's plans and substitute his own. Their army would be his. The biggest of the rocks is on its way to the port of Los Angeles. The Mother Rock, Peeks said. Ah, Drake said. I've been meaning to head into the city. That one piece? Well, you could transform an army with it. We could control a force like nothing the world has ever seen. We could crush any other mutant force. We could even fight HSTF-66 and the U.S. government to a standstill. Then what? The question surprised Peeks. He blinked. He hadn't really thought in detail about what happened next. he'd been focused on fantasies of revenge and self-justification.
Well then, I suppose you, Drake, if you've been a faithful lieutenant, could have whatever you like.
Drake leaned forward. He unlimbered his whip hand and poked a stick in the fire, sending up a cloud of sparks amid the smoke. Then, with his normal hand, he pulled his shredded t-shirt up over his head so that the face, the disgusting wire-filled mouth, could be seen clearly in all its disturbing horror.
"Tell the nice man what we want, Brittany Pig," Drake said.
The eyes opened, black-on-black eyes that reflected no light but seemed to blaze with a dark fire within. The glittering mouth spoke just one word.
"Fun."
"Fun?"
Feeks could not believe he was talking to a sort of three-dimensional living tattoo with broken braces, but Normal had left the building, and Crazy was in charge now.
"My kind of fun," Drake said. "You really are a psycho," Feeks said, shaking his head in amused disbelief.
To his surprise, Drake seemed to consider the idea seriously. He was silent for a while, long enough for Peaks to get nervous. At last, Drake said,
"I used to be this kid. Probably a little messed up, but still, this kid. Then Sam Temple burned me. Diana had to cut my arm off. Then the Gaiaphage gave me this."
He unwrapped his snake arm. He brought the tip close to Peaks' face, not quite touching, not quite threatening.
"I am what the Gaiaphage made me."
He laughed then.
"And they like it, the Dark Watchers. They like pain, which is good because so do I."
Then his mood changed abruptly.
"But don't call me a psycho or any other names you come up with. You can call me Drake or you can call me Whiphand. You call me anything else, old man, and I will make you scream my name till your throat is raw."
Well, Peaks thought, Decca had not overstated just what a monster Drake was. No, not even a little. He might make a useful ally if he can be controlled.
Big if, he admitted silently. Very big if.
Part 3. Rough Beasts. Chapter 20. First on the Scene. The port of Los Angeles was a massive, sprawling complex of docks and jetties, huge cranes for offloading containers, vast parking lots full of Japanese and Korean cars awaiting transportation to dealers, hundreds of container hauling trucks, warehouses, great cylindrical fuel tanks, motor pools, and squat, unadorned office buildings that looked like overgrown backyard sheds. All that was on the land, which had been shaped to form multiple bays and inlets and channels, but the land was mere servant to the sea and its ships and tugboats and pilot craft. Malik drove onto the Vincent Thomas Bridge, a smaller, uglier version of the Golden Gate Bridge that soared over the main channel, just high enough to allow loaded container ships to squeeze beneath. Traffic was sparse on the bridge, and Malik pulled over halfway across. Shade hopped out and went to the rail. To her left was the cruise ship terminal, where a sleek, massively top-heavy Emerald Princess was just tying off. Beyond it, closer to the open sea, was the retired battleship Iowa, its great guns long silenced. Two ships were in the channel, passing beneath the bridge. The Coast Guard cutter Berthold and the Okeanos Explorer. The Berthold, at 420 feet in length, was at once innocent and dangerous, blazingly white, with the usual red chevron slanted down the side of the bow, but with a Bofors 57mm gun in a turret ahead of the superstructure. That superstructure was topped by a mast festooned with sophisticated electronics. The Okeanos, which the Berthold had escorted into port, was half as long, white but lacking the sort of perfectly maintained, obsessively clean, and painted look of the Coast Guard ship. It was topped by what looked very much like a giant golf ball, a shell surrounding sophisticated radar and other sensors. Malik and Cruz joined Shade. She pointed and said, "They may not need a superhero. They have some kind of big cannon on that Coast Guard ship." "Just be ready," Malik snapped. "Sorry, I haven't slept in, like, forever." "That container must be for the Mother Rock," Cruz observed. "I think they're pulling in," Malik said, "across the channel." They hopped back into a freshly purloined SUV. The CHP car had been left in a Costco parking lot, crossed the bridge, followed an off-ramp that led down past seemingly endless expanses of concrete topped by stacked containers, scruffy warehouses and administrative buildings, crossed some railroad tracks, aimed right for the wharf where the Okeanos seemed to be heading, and ran into a number of signs, one stating that they were nearing Terminal Island, a Coast Guard base, and a second indicating that they were also approaching the Terminal Island Correctional Facility. "Great," Malik said darkly. "It'll be a short walk to prison." There was security in place, so they stopped again, considering their next move. "We need to get in there," Malik said. He glanced in the mirror and saw a white van approaching. "I got it," Shade said, and immediately began her transformation. She forced herself to look down at the monstrous insectoid legs that gave her such speed. Her flesh crept and her mind rebelled, still unable to really process it, unable to quite believe that she was physically something other than she'd been her whole life. The liquid sluicing sounds came through her bones as her body shifted and moved, as she quickly, down to mere seconds now, transformed into a creature that only a close friend would recognize as being Shade Darby. She glanced at Malik and Cruz. They were staring and blinking ever so slowly. The white van that had been tearing along at good speed was now barely moving. She ran to it and looked inside. There was only the driver, a burly 30-something white man in overalls. He had an ID lanyard hanging around his neck. Shade yanked open the van door and hauled out its driver as carefully as she could, although she heard one of the bones in his arm snap, and deposited him beside the road. She couldn't have him conscious, but he was an innocent bystander, so she slowed her fist so that when it impacted the side of his head, the blow wouldn't crush his skull. It did, however, snap his head around and cause his eyes to flutter and roll up in his head. He began a slow-mo collapse. Shade raced back to her friends and demorphed, feeling clever for having changed back before the Dark Watchers could fully turn their attention on her. "Come on," Shade said. "Cruz, I believe your power may come in handy." The three of them went to the white van, and Shade handed the unconscious driver's lanyard to Cruz. "Can you pass us this guy?" Cruz looped the lanyard over her neck and went to take a much closer look at the man, turning his head this way and that, adding it to what she had come to think of as her face file, the faces she had memorized well enough to mimic. By the time she stood up, she was the unconscious driver, clothing and all. "This good enough?" Cruz asked, a bit smug, knowing that, of course, it was perfect. "Okay, listen. You have to drive, Cruz. Malik and I can hide in the back, but you have to drive. But no alternative," Malik chimed in. "It's just, what, 500 feet to the security gate? You could do it, Cruz. You got this." "Straight road," Shade said, making a chopping gesture. "Oh my God," the driver said, sounding entirely like Cruz. I don't... There began a hurried, impromptu driving lesson from Malik as Shade shielded her eyes from the glare and squinted to see the cutter and the Okeanos closing with crane-burdened dock. As it happened, Cruz was perfectly able to drive slowly, with Malik behind her giving her instructions. At the gate, Cruz flashed her lanyard, and then the guard said, "See the game last night?" Of course, Cruz had not. But she read the guard's doleful expression and said, "We were robbed." The guard snorted. We were robbed when they traded away Vasquez.
Tell me about it, Cruz answered in her best approximation of a gruff and masculine voice.
And then they were in through the gate. The prison, not a huge facility, was on their left. The dock was to their right. Cruz scooted into the back as Malik clambered into the driver's seat, and they motored past low buildings to approach a parking lot with space for perhaps 100 cars. There was a whole new level of security in place in that parking lot. A dozen vehicles either marked LAPD or unmarked but clearly official. A big black LAPD SWAT van, the size of a UPS truck, waited beside a small armored car with massive rubber wheels painted with the stencil. The vehicle was marked Rescue LAPD. A Los Angeles Port Police motorboat cut figure eights into the gray-green water of the channel. A police helicopter hovered overhead. Their way forward was blocked by Port Police on motorcycles, with men and women in dark suits and dark glasses nearby. These did not look like folks who would be tricked by a lanyard. They would search the vehicle and demand to see specific permissions to enter the area. So again, Malik pulled over beside an improbable baseball diamond. A basketball court occupied the space between the baseball diamond and the parking lot. He made a point of leaning out of the window and staring, like any curious dock worker might upon seeing a very unusual sight. Even a boat suspected of bringing in drugs did not merit this kind of reception.
I can't get any closer, Malik said. I doubt even Cruz could get through.
Shade nodded. I can, but I don't want to until it's necessary. The less time I spend with the watchers, the better. The Okeanos touched the dock, but it did not remain quite still. It seemed to be drifting. Then, a strange figure covered by a poncho with hood pulled up despite the stunning Southern California weather rushed to the stern to throw a cable to waiting hands ashore. That same cloaked figure then ran forward to throw the second line.
What, have they only got one crewman?
Malik wondered aloud. And that was when a car pulled up just ahead of the parked van. Malik tensed. Shade watched, ready to morph at the first sign of trouble. She could see two heads silhouetted in the car. The driver got out. He was a middle-aged white man with sandy hair. He had a passenger with long, dirty blonde or light brown hair. The passenger turned in his seat and looked right at Malik, who instinctively shrank back. To the amazement of everyone in Shade's group, the middle-aged man now began stripping off his clothing, carefully folding each item and laying them on the driver's seat, until he was down to a pair of boxer shorts.
Crazy? Malik mused.
But then the pale, skinny, unimpressive, and mostly naked man began to change.
Worse than crazy, Shade said. He's a child of the Rock.
Chapter 21, Cooking Drake. Peaks folded his clothing with trembling hands. He saw a parked van, but there was just some kid at the wheel, and Peaks had bigger issues to deal with.
You coming? Peaks demanded.
Drake grinned. When I'm ready. I want to see what you've got first.
Peaks shook his head slightly and under his breath said,
I wish I knew what I've got.
Louder, he added,
What I've got, my friend, is big, hot, and unhappy.
Peaks focused his mind on the thoughts most likely to enrage him. In fact, he replayed the scene of his firing, of his humiliation, and change came to Tom Peaks. He heard a sound like wet gears grinding through mud, a sound that vibrated through his bones. The ground began to recede, seeming to fall away from him as he shot up. He looked down and saw misshapen feet already so large that they extended beneath the car, and down through the sunroof, he saw Drake watching him with wary blue eyes. Peaks raised his hand to look at it, and it was no longer human in size, color, or shape. His hand looked like one of those 4th of July snakes, like magma vomiting from the mouth of a volcano, black crust over a glowing red beneath. Peaks was perhaps the most experienced person on Earth when it came to the ASO virus and its effects. At the ranch, he had run many experiments, first on test animals and later on humans. He had seen the gruesome, disturbing morphing process, like something out of a demented movie special effects computer. He had seen it all, but in others, not himself. It was like being trapped in a nightmare, that same helpless feeling, that same dread, but against the astonishment and the fear was fascination. My God, look at me. He grew still, larger and larger, broader and broader, until he was as big as an African elephant. He glanced down, and now Drake was no longer smirking. There was an expression of something like awe on the creep's cruel face. That look calmed Peaks's fear. There was nothing as good for calming fear as seeing that you terrified someone else. Then, rage. It erupted inside Peaks like a muffled bomb of fury and hatred. A rage far out of proportion even to the indignities he'd suffered. He felt as if liquid fire was coursing in his veins, like a nuclear pile was burning in his gut. He felt exalted, transformed. The power. Peaks felt as well the presence of unseen eyes, a mocking, interested, malicious gaze, but that did not trouble him while he was in this state, not while he was rising ever upward on a geyser of mad fury. A red veil fell over his sight, and he felt himself, his mind, Tom Peaks himself, flickering like a candle about to go out. But that would not do. It would not do at all. He needed his wits about him. He needed to be able to see and react. And with all the determination at his command, he held on to his consciousness, retained awareness, moving fingers and feet to prove to himself that he controlled this beastly body. But with this accomplishment came the certainty that his control over this monster was tenuous at best. It was as if the creature had a simple, brutal mind of its own, a rage-fueled single-mindedness that competed with Peaks's own sophisticated consciousness for control. It was a bit like two drivers trying to steer the same vehicle. He could direct his morph, but could not entirely contain its fury. He was far above the car now, towering over it so that Drake might as well have been a pedestrian passing on the sidewalk beneath a 5-story building. And that was when Peaks made a mistake he would not have made had he had more time to test out this morph. He glared down at Drake, and the rage took control. Peaks roared down at Drake, roared in a voice that shattered the windshield and set off the car alarm, and as he opened his mouth and roared, a wave of liquid fire vomited forth. It was napalm, some rational corner of Peaks's mind observed, like jellied gasoline, and it did not burn like a flame or even a blowtorch. It stuck and burned. Gallons of it sprayed across the vehicle, instantly peeling paint, dripping down into the car through the sunroof, melting seats and dashboard controls, wilting the steering wheel, sending up a cloud of stinking, oily black smoke. And Drake, too, burned. He burned and his flesh melted from his face, so that Peaks saw a flame-wreathed skeleton with blue eyes sizzling like frying eggs in their bone sockets. Drake calmly opened the door of the car, rolled out onto the grass of the baseball diamond, and kept rolling as the napalm clung to him, burning, peeling skin away, frying the meager fat, boiling his blood. Drake rolled, keeping his whip hand tightly coiled around him, then jumped up to run across the grassy field, dropping flaming gobbets of melting flesh as he ran. A long, narrow gap separated the land from the dock, a gap forming a sort of freshwater ditch between dock and land. Drake leaped and disappeared from sight. For a terribly long time, Peaks stared in furious horror, dimly aware that he had gone to great trouble to recruit a henchman and had now killed him. But then, a whip snapped up from the water, and the end wrapped around a tall, lithe palm tree, and with a single powerful yank, a dripping wet Drake landed nimbly back on the grass. He was more skeleton than flesh, white bone clearly visible, his skull, his ribs, one entire shoulder. What flesh remained was the color of a steak left to burn on a too-hot grill. And yet, from the upper part of Drake's chest, a tangle of chrome wires protruded. But perhaps most terrifying of all, Drake's whip hand was now a snake skeleton,
a long, flexible vertebral column, and hundreds of circular ribs.
You're alive?
Peaks roared, meaning to whisper. You'll have to give me a few minutes, Drake said, sauntering quite nonchalantly back across the grass from third base, not even seeming resentful. It takes me a while to regrow.
Chapter 22. Fire, Water, and Shade Darby.
Jesus H. Godzilla, Malik said through chattering teeth.
The creature that had once been an unremarkable middle-aged man now towered over them, and unless Shade was hallucinating, he had just melted a boy with a long octopus-looking arm, and that boy had just climbed out of the car, jumped into the water, and emerged like some unkillable slasher movie villain.
Cruz screamed in sheer out-of-control terror. Malik's face was a mask of horror, teeth bared, eyes wide. Shade's insides turned to water. She felt a desperate urge to find a bathroom, preferably one on another continent. But she did not scream. She had no right to scream. She was a monster, too, or would be in mere seconds.
Malik, she grabbed his shoulder. You and Cruz, get the hell out of here. Now. I have to...
But what she had to do was not made clear, because the magma creature had turned his attention back to the Okeanos, nestling up to the dock.
It began to run.
One step and he was 20 feet away, another great bounding step on legs as long as telephone poles and as thick as ancient redwoods. The vibration of each planted foot was like a low-level earthquake.
He's not exactly slow himself, Shade muttered as she pushed open the door and stood on legs not quite her own.
The police forces in the parking lot didn't need to be told to fire. They blazed away with handguns and shotguns, but if the bullets struck the magma creature, there was no sign that they were a problem for him. And then the monster threw wide his arms, a defiant, "Is that all you got?" gesture. Bang, 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 bang. The police fired until their clips were empty, reloaded, and fired again, and all to no effect. The monster bent to bring his hideous, burned reptile head lower, mouth wide in a grin full of fire and smoke. He let go a sound that even from more than 100 yards shook Shade down to her bones. They had made a stop at a martial arts store and picked up various weapons for Shade, throwing stars, nunchucks, an actual sword, but they were pitiful stuff to use against this creature. Shade retrieved a pathetically small knife and an absurd set of nunchucks and realized, looking at them, that she had no chance. No chance at all.
Run, Shade. Run away.
She could be in the next county in 5 minutes' run. She could be in Mexico in 20 minutes. This creature was orders of magnitude too strong, too dangerous for her to battle.
But you've got nunchucks,
a savagely sarcastic inner voice reminded her.
I need a damn tank.
She glanced at Malik and Cruz, frozen in their slowness. Hero, villain, or monster, Shade said shakily. And I'm supposed to be the hero. In her imagination, it had always been a battle against the blood-smeared girl, against Gaia. In her fantasies, she'd had powers of her own, and though the battle had been hard, she had always prevailed. She had always triumphed. Her throat had never been cut. There had been no scar to serve as a constant reminder that she, Shade Darby, was responsible for her mother's death. That she, Shade Darby, had been helpless and weak. But this was not fantasy. This creature was 30 or 40 feet, a very real fire and death. I can't beat that. If she turned away, if she ran like every ounce of her brain was screaming at her to, it would all be for nothing. She'd have condemned Cruz and Malik and herself to eventual prison. She'd have ruined her father's career. All for nothing. Was this how real-world heroes felt? Trapped? Too committed to run away? You didn't see that in the movies, Shade thought. You didn't see the bone-rattling fear that came with facing deadly battle. Hopeless battle.
He'll kill me. He'll kill me.
She had impetuously attacked Nightmare at the lighthouse, but she'd figured she could hold her own with him. Nightmare was big and dangerous, but this magma beast wasn't some art student playing the villain and waving his sword around. This was death made flesh.
What a fool she had been. What an arrogant, stupid fool. And now, she could either run away and live with the knowledge of her cowardice, or endure the pity of Malik and Cruz, and then their bitter resentment that their lives had been disrupted, and perhaps shattered, for nothing. For nothing. For nothing but my fantasies. Fight or flight. Basic human hardwired survival instincts. Fight or flight. She had read somewhere that every battle at some point turns on the willingness of one person to run toward danger or to turn and flee. Fight or flight. The answer, when at last it came, should have been a triumphant shout, but it came out as a shaky, doomed whisper. Fight. Shade kicked off and zoomed after the creature, as he kicked at police cars, crumpling them like empty beer cans. Shade saw a police officer, his uniform aflame, flying through the air like a football. The monster was fast, able to move at more than human speed, but Shade was moving at bullet speed, and she easily caught him. She raced rings around him, dodging gobbets of fire that dribbled from his mouth, looking for vulnerabilities, for weaknesses, but he was to all intents and purposes a massive pile of walking magma. From 20 feet away, it was like sticking your head into a pizza oven. The heat of his touch boiled the tarmac beneath his great reptilian feet. And in Shade's head, the dark watchers leaned forward, excited, like spectators at a football game. Shade took a step back, and then another. The magma creature had not yet seen her. She could still run, should run. But now, she noticed something about the creature. The black crust of rock was no longer morphing. It had steadied, becoming what it was now, a sort of jigsaw puzzle of oddly shaped plate armor, like poorly made chainmail, hard, cooled, though still blisteringly hot, volcanic rock over a core of fire. An idea formed in the cold, clear core that in so many ways defined Shade Darby. Terrified, roasting hot, appalled and overwhelmed, she nevertheless thought. Shade raced back to the SUV. Malik had made no effort to leave. On the contrary, he had one foot out the door and Cruz had begun to open her own door. The fools are coming to help me? Against that? She vibrated to a slowness that was barely tolerable and said, "Get out! Run! Run!" Then she popped the back door, shoved the gate upward so hard and fast that one hinge snapped and the whole rear door hung by a thread. There she found what she was looking for, the golf bag that had belonged to the owner of the SUV. Balls and clubs. She grabbed some of the throwing stars as well, tossing them into a small runner's backpack, which she slung over her shoulder and then, cursing a blue streak to keep her courage up, zoomed back to the creature, who now was nearly at the docked Okeanos. She pulled out a club and beat it on the ground until the head twisted off, leaving a somewhat bent, high tensile strength shaft with a jagged end. Deep breath. Insane. Deep breath. Hero time. Gripping the pointy club, she raced straight at the creature, sighted the gap between two hard plates that formed part of his right lower calf, just above where his Achilles tendon would be if he had such a thing, and with all her considerable might, with a power driven by shocking speed, Shade leaped and stabbed the shaft deep into the red marrow. She bounced off the creature, and to her relief, felt no pain. It was like quickly touching an iron to test its heat. Sparks flew, but they flew too slowly to reach her. The monster was as hot as the center of a volcano, hot enough to melt lead and copper bullets, but it was not hot enough to melt the golf club's titanium shaft. The monster's next step was a stumble, and while it was still plowing forward trying to catch its balance, Shade grabbed a second club and plunged it into a narrow gap on the top of its opposite foot, and then the magma beast fell. It fell directly toward a policeman who stared up, paralyzed with horror. Shade ran, grabbed the policeman, and shoved him out of the way, snapping ribs like twigs, but better that than being crushed. Too late, she saw a policewoman still in her patrol car, and the magma creature crashed down on her like a rock slide, sending up showers of sparks and smoke. Shade heard a desperate cry, quickly annihilated. The monster was fast on his feet, but not so fast at standing up. He disentangled himself from the police car, crushed to half its normal height. A burning hand stuck out from the crumpled windshield. The beast stared quizzically at the two small shafts and pulled them out like they were splinters. The beast stood, but
but even before he was fully erect, he opened his mouth and, with a glottal roar that sounded like 100 men vomiting at once, sprayed forth a gusher of liquid fire. Shade backed away quickly as the napalm fell, and a pillar of flame and smoke swirled like a tornado around the great monster. The creature was fast, not fast enough to catch Shade, but too fast for her to manage as easily as she'd have liked. The fire that blew from that gaping jaw was faster still, forming an obstacle course of melting tarmac and tornadoes of smoke. If she wasn't careful, she could too easily run into the flame, and she was not at all sure it wouldn't burn her, however fast she was. Worse than his quickness was the simple fact of his size. She wasn't going to stop him by stabbing at his ankles. She had to be able to inflict more damage than that. She had to be able to cripple or even kill the creature. The shark Shade Darby supplied an answer. The eyes. She could try to blind it, just as she had destroyed one of Nightmare's eyes. Unfortunately, this thing's eyes were in a head that was now way, way up in the air. A leap? Could she make it? And could she land somewhere safe? She backed up and took a run that quickly turned into great bounding steps, like a high jumper approaching the bar, culminating in a leap. It was like nothing she had done to this point. It was the next best thing to flying, but her first leap missed the head and instead landed her feet first against the massive chest, from which she could only rappel away, turning a neat somersault in the air before landing hard enough to knock the wind from her. Shade lay stunned on the concrete, sucking for air that would not come. She glanced up just in time to see the devilish eyes focus on her, see her for the first time.
"You,"
the monster roared. That single, comprehensible syllable, coming from the fire breather, was surprising. But then, in a voice that sounded huge and clotted, and yet was understandable, he said,
"I believe I have the pleasure of speaking to Shade Darby."
Shade blinked. What? It knew who she was? How do you know my name?
"I thought you might be here,"
the monster said, dribbling fire like random punctuation.
"Something my new friend Drake said. At first I didn't catch it, but then I knew. They want us here. They've been guiding us here."
"What the hell are you talking about?"
"We are their playthings,"
the monster said, sounding almost regretful.
"Smile. You're on TV."
"Go away," Shade said, suddenly acutely aware that she had no clever banter for this situation, no cocky Spider-Man bon mots to toss out. "I will stop you."
"Will you, Shade Darby? Will you? But of course you have to try, don't you? Ah, well, we must strut and fret our hour upon the stage, eh?"
He vomited fire at her. She backed away, still puzzling out how this creature could know her name. She backed away just quickly enough to avoid the edge of the fire as it crept toward her. Fast enough, but too distracted to look behind her as a thick whip, bone and oozing flesh, wrapped itself with speed to match her own around her waist. Chapter 23. Late to the Party. There were no longer guards on the gate at the Port of Los Angeles by the time Decca and Armo arrived. The gate was wide open, and cars were racing out. People, too. Dock workers and folks in short-sleeve white shirts and ties, running in panic. Decca noticed a police officer running and shedding his gun belt, as if he was quitting the force right at that moment.
"Looks like things started without us," Decca said.
A pillar of smoke like something from a tire fire rose from the dock, boiling into the blue sky, almost obscuring the Okeanos, tying off to the dock. The Coast Guard held position in the channel, the cutter's deck lined with sailors pointing.
"What the hell is that?"
Armo asked, his mouth near Decca's ear. Decca was creeping the Kawasaki forward against the tide of fleeing workers, coming around to a clearer view. Decca pulled off the scrunchie she'd used to keep her dreads from slapping Armo, shook them out, and said,
"That is big trouble. That's what that is."
It was massive, a black jigsaw puzzle over a core of blazing orange fire. Its head was reptilian, like a Komodo dragon's,
but no snake-like tongue tested the breeze. Instead, liquid fire dribbled from a cavernous mouth, ringed with teeth like black diamonds.
Damn, Armo said. What the hell do we do with that?
Dekka said nothing for a full minute. She had told Peaks she wouldn't be his soldier. She had said her war was over. And yet, when Armo had suggested coming here because here was where the Mother Rock would be, she had agreed. Why? Because life as Jean from Safeway is boring.
I used to know someone, Dekka said. A girl. She died in the phase.
Yeah? Armo said, puzzled. She died because she went out to fight one too many times.
I told her. Everyone told her. No, don't. You can't win, Breeze. You'll die.
Tears filled Dekka's eyes. But she went, and she died.
So, you're saying we do the smart thing and turn your bike around?
Armo asked. That would be the smart thing to do, Dekka said. Look at that thing. That thing belongs in a movie.
Scariest thing I've ever seen, and I was at the ranch, Armo said with a sigh.
That was her grave I stopped at, you know, up in Perdido Beach. None so bold. That's what's on her tombstone. Dekka's voice changed as she said,
You were bold, Breeze. Goddamn, you were bold and brave and crazy.
Then her tone changed again, hardening.
I love that girl. I don't know if she's up in some kind of heaven, watching, but if she is, well, she'd be pretty ashamed of me if I just walked away now.
Armo said, I didn't know your Breeze person, but I know common sense. And common sense says that thing there cannot be beat by the two of us.
Dekka nodded. I understand.
You make your own choices, Armo. I figured that much out about you.
Armo laughed. You understand squat. I've never chickened out of anything yet. I'm not going to start now.
But hell, look at that thing. It's like fighting a dragon.
He shook his head in amusement, as though this was all an entertaining joke.
My family goes all the way back to Bjorn Ironside, a very badass Viking. Tell you what, if old Bjorn had ever run into a dragon, he'd sure as hell have gone after it.
You're gonna go die because you're descended from some crazy-ass Viking?
You're gonna go die for some girl named Breeze?
I am.
Me too, then,
Armo said. Dekka shook her head and laughed. Well then, white boy, should we get started?
You're the one driving, Armo said.
Dekka gunned the engine, and the bike leaped eagerly. They were both morphing before they had cut the distance in half. Dekka glanced around for a safe place to park her motorcycle, realized there was no longer any such thing as safe, and simply left it. The magma creature spotted her walking steadily toward him, already morphed, and laughed.
Why, it's Dekka Talent!
That caused Dekka to miss a step. How did the creature know her?
Don't you recognize me, Dekka the Righteous?
The monster sneered.
It's your old friend, Tom Peaks. Although, I think it's time for a name change. So call me Napalm. Napalm, you like it?
Of course, Dekka thought grimly. Of course. Peaks.
And I have another friend of yours, too. Napalm crowed. You can call him Whiphand.
Dekka stopped dead. Armo ran past her, roaring as he ran, but beyond him Dekka saw the one thing more terrifying than Peaks. Drake Merwin was squeezing the life from someone who looked like a bizarre cross between a flea, a Power Ranger, and a teenaged girl. Armo leaped, sailed through the air straight at Napalm, roaring as he flew, but the brave roar ended abruptly as Napalm simply swatted him aside, like a mosquito. Every fiber of Dekka's being wanted to go at Drake. She had hated him for a year in the phase, hated him since, hated him when Peaks had shown her the video, and hated him now, hated his cruel eyes and his chiseled cheeks, and hated above all the twisting, writhing python tightening relentlessly around the unknown super. But Dekka was not new to combat. Dekka was a veteran of many, many fights, many, many battles. She was only 19, but she was old in war, and she knew Drake was a distraction. Peaks was after the Mother Rock, and that was to be the point of this fight. Armo! Dekka yelled. Take out Whip Hand!
Armo, lying winded on the ground, heard Dekka, and what he heard from her sounded a lot like an order. Instinctively, he rejected it. No one told Armo what to do. No one. He was going after, and then Dekka stopped, looked right at him, and said, Please?
Orders? Armo did not take orders. Requests? Well...
He threw Dekka a mock salute with his paw and charged straight at Drake.
Now let's talk, Tom Napalm Peaks, you liar, you criminal freak,
Dekka said. She raised her hands, palm out, opened her mouth, and shrieked. Instantly, Napalm's volcanic rock shell began to come apart. Flakes of stone rained down like hail, and Napalm bellowed in outrage. He opened his mouth and ejected a mass of lava. Dekka's shredding lacerated the molten rock, sent drops in every direction, but too much got through. A glob of liquid fire attached to Dekka's forearm, another to her belly. She backed away, batting at the fire, but it stuck to her claws now, and even her higher pain threshold did little to lessen the excruciating, imperative, panic-inducing agony of burning alive. Dekka dropped her hands and dodged sideways seconds ahead of a full load of fire that spilled across the ground she'd occupied, spread out in a puddle, and reached the tires of a parked car. The tires melted and burned. The heat of the fire was so intense that the fur on Dekka's arms singed and curled. Her snake dreads twisted away, sheltering behind her head. Armo, looking like some deranged artist's conception of a polar bear mated with a human, ran straight at Drake. Straight at Shade, an out-of-control berserker beast in a furious charge. Drake frowned and tried to jump aside, but in the process, he lessened his grip on Shade for just a split second that was the equivalent of a leisurely 10 seconds to Shade. She bent her knees back, dropped through his coiled arm, and then stumbled forward, landing on hands and knees in the liquid fire.
Ah!
Came the mosquito buzz of pain. Armo hit Drake like a ton of bricks and sent him skidding on his back. But Drake was quick and, like Dekka, was a veteran of many fights. He rolled to his feet and aimed his whip and Armo ran straight into him again. An irresistible force, a wild white-furred beast gone absolutely mad, slashing with its diamond-hard claws, biting with steel teeth, pummeling with knees and elbows, a whirlwind of incoherent, insane animal violence.
You brought a sidekick? Dekka said to Napalm.
Me too.
Once again, she raised her hands, trying to ignore the pain of burns, and again, the stony shell began to come apart, to disintegrate. It was like a time-lapse video of a mountain eroding, but still small drops of fire burned Dekka. She was hurting Napalm, but not fast enough, and this time the liquid fire was a flood, a fire hose spreading smoking destruction. Napalm turning his head from side to side. The magma rolled into and over Dekka's feet, and she screamed, an eerie part feline howl of pain and terror and rage. The fire spread toward Drake as well, on his back beneath Armo's berserker onslaught. Drake dug in his heels and tried to scoot himself away, but like a tsunami, the fire swept around him, frying him like a piece of pork fat in a barbecue. Drake felt no pain, but the fire did damage, eating into the sinews of his newly regrown back, melting the meager flesh of his buttocks. The face on Drake's chest howled in shrill hysteria. Armo's knees were in the flames, and if anything could penetrate his berserker madness, that was it. He jumped back, balanced atop Drake, and used him as a launch pad to leap free. Dekka was beyond pain. Her feet were melting. Flame ran up the fur that covered her. She screamed in pure panic, screamed and ran as flame engulfed her, ran as flame rose to blind her, straight for the water, straight toward the Okeanos. Water, water. Napalm turned away with a derisive laugh, and with long strides marched unstoppable after her, the Okeanos momentarily forgotten in his hunger to annihilate one of the two young women who had destroyed his career and life's work. The Coast Guard cutter then opened up suddenly, spraying Napalm with machine gun fire. To no effect. A military helicopter gunship arrived in a rush, tilted forward, a deadly matte black insect. It launched a missile that hit Napalm squarely in the shoulder, exploded, and blew smoking chunks of volcanic rock from him,
bearing a patch of fire like some inflamed scab. Napalm bellowed incoherently, wordlessly at the helicopter, but did not slow his progress. Now the Coast Guard opened up with the Bofors gun. Its 57-millimeter shells carried less punch than the missile, but it could fire 200 rounds a minute, 3 rounds a second, and its aim was accurate. The shells exploded against Napalm's chest like a jackhammer. Bam, 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 bam. Napalm took a step back, took another, and dodged to his left, which placed the Okeanos' superstructure between himself and the Bofors gun. The shelling stopped. Dekka hit the water and was already demorphing by the time the oily liquid closed over her head. As she changed, the clinging liquid fire was drowned by the water and fell away. She stayed under as long as her wind lasted, then pushed back into the air and began clambering up over sharp rocks. To her intense relief, the burning pain was gone. She raised a foot from the water and saw that it was still there, and human once again. But now the memory of the flames consuming her weighed her down, made her hesitate. The Dark Watchers did not like that, not at all. And with urgent silence, they cheered her on. A burning Armo suddenly splashed into the water beside her. He thrashed and roared until he, too, resumed his normal human shape. The two of them, beaten, terrified, and with searingly recent memories of unimaginable pain, bobbed in the oily water, trembling from cold and fear. And Napalm faced the Okeanos, ready to claim his prize. Chapter 24. There's Always Something Worse. Shade Darby demorphed to escape the pain. It was unlike anything she had ever endured before. Her morphed hands and knees were burned deep, burned to the bones, and it was agony that all but obliterated thought. But as she resumed her normal form, she felt the pain disappear and sighed in momentary relief. It was an important fact. She could change shapes, and each time the shape, herself or the morphed herself, was renewed, fresh and unmarked. She ran at human normal speed back to Cruz and Malik. Malik put his arms around her, and she shook as if she was freezing. Cruz hugged her from behind, and to her amazement, Cruz felt Shade sobbing. In the near distance, Drake could be seen staggering around almost comically. His entire back, the backs of his calves, his buttocks, were all melted. He looked as if he was made out of Play-Doh. His burned muscles could not walk properly, but he did not seem to be in pain, just unable to move very well, as he lurched after Napalm like a poorly made robot. Moving was not a problem for the creature calling itself Napalm. It was at the Okeanos. Shade freed herself from Malik, but gently, and wiped her eyes. "That was bad," she said. She needed no embellishments. They had seen. Napalm was unstoppable. Shade had tried and nearly died. Two others with morphs and powers had joined the fight and been similarly brushed aside. "Let's get out of here," Malik said. "We're not winning this fight." Shade's eyes were bleak, like nothing Cruz had ever seen. She seemed empty. She did not argue with Malik, but she didn't get in the car either. Instead, stood staring, hollow-eyed after the mighty monster. "If we all worked together..." Cruz hadn't even meant to say it out loud. "Together against that?" Malik pointed, incredulous. "That girl with the dreads is badass, but her partner is basically just a big pissed-off bear." And Shade had done enough, more than enough. He put a protective arm around Shade, and again, she let him. "There's me," Cruz said. Malik stared at her. Shade raised her eyes. "No," Shade said. "No, no, no, you'll die. You'll die, Cruz, and it will be my fault. Again." "Don't, Shade," Malik said tenderly, leaning his forehead against hers, looking her in the eyes. "It was not your fault then. It never was." Not Shade's fault then, Cruz thought, but Malik wasn't denying that what was happening here and now was Shade's fault. And wasn't it? It wasn't Malik, or for that matter, Cruz, who had become twisted by guilt and obsessed with finding a way to reverse her earlier weakness. It wasn't Malik or Cruz who had laid plans to steal the rock. It was Shade's fault. It was. "But whose fault will it be if more people die while I do nothing?" Cruz asked herself. Cruz felt herself moving without meaning to move, walking without quite intending to. It was as if her body had made a decision her brain was not yet ready to endorse. But she did not stop, not even when Malik yelled, "Get back here, you idiot!" The stocky black girl with ripped and burned clothing stood now beside a very tall white boy, both with their backs to her, both staring at the scene unfolding. "Hey, I'm Cruz. My speedy friend back there is Shade Darby. I think maybe we're all on the same side?" Dekka and Armo spun toward her, tensed for a fight. But on seeing Cruz with her hands up as if surrendering, they relaxed.
"Do you have powers?" Dekka snapped.
"A little. I can look like other people." Cruz demonstrated by turning briefly into Katy Perry, then back. She half expected this formidable pair to laugh, but they exchanged a look, Dekka and Armo.
"Have to stay behind him," Armo said to Dekka. "That's his only weak spot, and it isn't real weak. But head to head, he just spews and everything burns."
"How's your friend?" Dekka asked. "Not great," Cruz admitted. Dekka nodded.
"Yeah, been there." "You know what you do with a fire?" Armo said. "You put it out, right?"
"Knock him into the water?" Dekka asked skeptically.
"He's close," Armo said. "Ship is kind of in the way."
Dekka sighed. "Okay, you, Cruz, your job is to distract him. We'll hit him from behind if Armo agrees. We'll try to knock him over down by the water." Dekka peered closely at Cruz. "You think you could do this?" Cruz didn't trust her voice. She didn't trust her body either, but it was apparently making all the decisions, so she turned and started walking fast, breaking into a run and veering left, winding through crushed and burning vehicles, aiming to get to the left of Napalm. It wasn't far, just a quarter of a mile perhaps, and as she ran, she heard Napalm's voice shout,
"Ahoy there, Okeanos! I am Napalm! Give me the rock! Give me the rock or burn!"
If any of the ship's crew was answering, Cruz did not hear them, nor could she see any of them, at least not at first. Then she saw a hooded figure walk calmly up to the side of the ship and look up at Napalm. The hooded figure must have said something because Napalm roared, "Give me the rock or die!" More inaudible conversation, and then Napalm began counting down. 10. 9. Cruz had reached the edge of the pier, up near the Okeanos's stubby bow. What would distract Napalm? Then she knew. The idea came fully formed, but was it possible? She searched her memory for shapes she had assumed. Some had been larger than her true self. She had looked the part, but when Shade or Malik touched her, they sometimes found they were touching air. She, Cruz, continued to exist. The changes were an illusion, basically a hologram. So it should be possible. Cruz began to change. It was easier with a living model right in front of her. It was an exceedingly bizarre thing, unlike any of her previous efforts, for always before she had become humans, humans whose eyes would be at least close to her own eyes in height. But now, her altered appearance, her holographic self, was so huge that she, Cruz, was like a tourist standing on the bottom tread of the stairs that led up inside the Statue of Liberty. She could see her version of Napalm from the inside, as if she were standing behind a movie screen, seeing things from behind, except that she was within. Napalm's eyes were 40 feet up, and Cruz's eyes were only a little over 5 feet off the ground. She saw through the hologram, seeing her own illusory volcanic rock skin and orange fire, but as a translucent filter. But when she moved her hands, the holographic hands moved. "Hey, you!" Cruz yelled. Napalm turned and froze in place. He was staring at himself, a perfect mirror image. "What?" Napalm said, in a surprisingly puzzled, unmonsterish voice. Two identical, nearly 50-foot-tall, living volcanoes stared at each other down the length of the dock. Cruz was all too aware that his fiery spew could reach her, drench her, burn her to death. Fear choked Cruz, and most of her brain was yammering, "Run, run, run!"
And now, the unwelcome guests, the Dark Watchers, they were curious, surprised. Cruz almost felt an a pleased expectation from them, as if they were watching a movie and were surprised by a sudden plot twist.
"Who are you?"
Napalm demanded, and that was when Dekka morphed once more, came running up behind Napalm, raised her hands, and screeched. Napalm twisted frantically, but Dekka moved with him, staying behind him, out of sight, peeling layers of stone from him. Napalm batted helplessly at his back with stubby arms and roared in pain and frustration. Armo had morphed and dived into the water by the stern of the Okeanos. He came up now through the gap between the pier and the ship, white fur soaking wet. He dug claws into pilings and climbed the tarry wood like a squirrel going up a tree. Then, with one tremendous effort, he leaped into Napalm, bounced off, hit the side of the ship, and propelled himself off, bounced again against Napalm, and leaped higher still until he was atop the upper deck of the Okeanos, from where he clambered madly up the mast beneath the golf ball. Then, almost eye level with Napalm, he kicked off with a mad roar, landed on Napalm's head, and gripped him. Steam rose from Napalm's head, and the pain seared Armo, but he did not jump away, holding on grimly for as long as he could, while Dekka shredded the monster's back, and Napalm staggered blindly and in pain, slammed against the side of the ship, all the while batting at Armo and twisting to get at Dekka, and for a while, hope flared in Cruz's breast. They were winning. Then the big loading crane on the dock came to life with a whir of electric motors. The sturdy steel arm, an arm capable of lifting entire containers as if they were no heavier than a Lego, swung in an arc toward Napalm. At the last second, a steaming, charred Armo jumped free. The crane arm struck Napalm in the shoulder and knocked him hard against the ship. Fire spilled onto the decks. Dekka never ceased in her attack, while Armo slunk away to change back to pain-free human form. Cruz stared at the crane, at the glass-enclosed cabin, and saw the strange, plasticine version of Shade. The crane backed away, then swung its ponderous weight again and hit Napalm in the